DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
On this week's show, meet the Sunni, Christian and Yazidi fighters training to take back their home of Mosul from Islamic State militants.
We visit a school in Pakistan whose principal calls Osama bin Laden a hero. What do the authorities have to say about it?
That could be personal freedom of speech or expression for anyone. For closing down a madrasa, any arms training, any militancy training can be a basis. Or if anyone is being taught to kill.
These stories and more coming up on Worldlink. You're listening to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
Well, we are deeply concerned by reports that ISIL is attacking and has taken control of the ancient town of Palmyra. Palmyra is, as you know, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's the home to historic ruins and other artifacts that are, ironically enough, critical to our understanding of this culture and to the history of the Iraqi and Syrian people.
White House press spokesman Josh Earnest there. Palmyra in Syria, Ramadi in Iraq, two more cities which in the past few days have been added to the list of those taken over by the self-proclaimed Islamic State. The militant group now controls about half of Syria's territory and a sizable portion of Iraq.
It's been almost a year since the IS takeover of the ancient Iraqi city of Mosul brought them to the world's attention. As the Iraqi army fled the militant onslaught, some 500,000 people followed. But now, a volunteer army is preparing to help retake the city they were forced to abandon. Hamani G went to meet them.
On a windy plain at the foot of Bashika Mountain, 15 kilometres northeast of Mosul, Colonel Ahmed is putting a small group of soldiers through their paces.
They're good. They obey orders, but we can improve them with more training. I'm selecting the ones who aren't performing and making them repeat the exercises.
Most of the trainees have some previous experience in the military or police force, but basic training here only lasts 3 weeks, compared to the 3 years Ahmed had when he was in the Iraqi army.
We are doing our best to teach them as far as we can. I'm tough with them. But outside of work, we're brothers. Brothers and friends.
Like everyone here at the small training camp, Colonel Ahmed is from the Iraqi province of Nineveh. Named after one of the oldest cities in recorded history, Nineveh province stretches across northwestern Iraq, bordering Syria to its west and the Kurdistan region to the east. The provincial capital, Mosul, once a vibrant and ethnically diverse metropolis, has been under the occupation of the Islamic State, or Daesh as they're known here, for almost a year. Towns and villages across Nineveh have also fallen to the militants, and hundreds of thousands of Arabs, Kurds, Christians, Yazidi, Sunni and Shabak have been displaced. When the Iraqi army of then-Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki fled the Islamic State assault last year, Mosul's residents couldn't defend themselves. Now they want a second chance, says Camp Commander General Mohammed al-Talab, who served in the Iraqi army for over 20 years, until 2003.
We were cheated by al-Maliki's army. They pulled out all their forces from the city without fighting, so Mosul collapsed very fast. People in Nineveh did not have any weapons, any tools. They couldn't fight with a stick. So the Daesh controlled the city very fast. We are here to fight, to show the Daesh we are united. We will fight and we will drive them out.
In January, Atil Nujafi, the exiled governor of Nineveh province, opened Camp Bashika, explains Firaz Hazem, a translator and liaison officer at the camp.
There is rumors said Mosul people would not fight for Mosul. So he improved the negative. So he said, no, there are many people who want to fight for their city, but they do not have tools or the they do not prepare them for the that defending. We want to improve that the Mosuls have the ability to fight for their city so that we collect this group to fighting for the city. They are from all varieties of from people. Arabs, Sunni, Yazidi, Shebeki, Christian, all the people, they came here.
Over 950 soldiers have already completed basic training, living together in small bivouacs lined up around the canteen at the centre of the camp. Another 8,000 volunteers have signed up, but a lack of space, money and weapons means the camp can only take a few hundred at a time. Those who do get here learn to use Kalashnikov and heavier artillery. And in preparation for when they enter the city of Mosul, they're sometimes taken to a nearby town to be trained in urban warfare. But soldiers and commanders alike say they desperately need more weapons. 23-year-old Zaid is a Sunni Arab from Rabia. He's been at the camp for 10 days.
I can learn anything, any type of fighting, but I'm asking the central government to urgently send us weapons. I came here to fight the Daesh because they destroyed Mosul and separated all the people, the Christians, the Yazidi, the Shabak.
But at Bashika, all those groups are working together, says Dilshad, a 27-year-old Yazidi.
We are taught to respect each other and work together. We have to be united to work as one hand. The Christians cannot liberate Mosul by themselves. The Yazidi cannot liberate Mosul by themselves. And I will gather my friends, whether they're Muslim, Christian or Shabak, and we will come together and fight the Daesh.
General Luis Yusuf Eshak is second in command at the camp and a Christian from the nearby town of Karakosh. The soldiers here have one thing in common, he says, regardless of their religious or ethnic background.
They all want revenge. The Daesh have taken their city. They have taken their money, their houses. This is what motivates them. It makes them want to join this camp and fight the Daesh. This is their homeland, and they want revenge.
General Eshak also has a message for the central government in Baghdad and for the international community. We have the soldiers, he says. What we need now is your support.
Hamani G sent us that report from northern Iraq near the city of Mosul.
The European Union is pushing forward with plans for a military intervention aimed at stopping the people smuggling trade, which has seen thousands of migrants perish trying to reach Europe. More than 5,000 people have drowned in the past 18 months as traffickers have taken advantage of the breakdown of authority in Libya to pack rickety boats with paying migrants and launch them across the Mediterranean.
For an insight into the situation in Libya, I spoke with Reuters senior correspondent for the Middle East, Ulf Lessing, currently in the city of Tripoli. I began by asking him how the Coast Guard is responding to the traffickers.
There's almost every day, you know, a boat leaving for Italy, you know, packed with, you know, 100 or 200 people. The Libyan Coast Guard, they try to stop them, but their options are limited. They just have, you know, this so-called Central Coast Guard Command, like covering a third of the Libyan coast. They just have three functioning boats, so there are very limits what they can do to stop this kind of trade.
And why has Libya become such a hub for this migration?
Because there's no real state authority left. You have two governments, you know, in Libya. One is the official, the internationally recognized one, which is based in eastern Libya, since they lost control of western Libya. They have no power. They work out of hotels. There's just no ministries following them. Whereas in western Libya, you have a non-recognized government controlling the capital and much of western Libya. That makes it very difficult to coordinate anything. Apart from that, both governments control only very limited territory, and they rely on former anti-Gaddafi rebels. They don't really have much power and control much, and that gives an opening to anyone who wants to do, you know, not just people smuggling, also wants to smuggle petrol or engage in any form of illegal criminal activities.
What does this split within Libya mean for EU efforts to launch military operations against the smugglers?
The main problem is that, as you mentioned, their counterparts are in the east, they have no power, and the smugglers go from western Libya because it's much closer to Lampedusa and Italy. It wouldn't make sense to go on these small, unsafe boats from eastern Libya. They would never reach, you know, Italian shore. So everything is done in western Libya. But here in western Libya, the European Union is not cooperating with authorities. So there would be some kind of unilateral action they could do. But I think if they really wanted to stop people smuggling, they would have to reach some sort of agreement with the government that actually controls the shore. I mean, their partners are in the east, but they're clearly powerless, working out of hotels.
Ulf, what do ordinary Libyans think of the EU's plan to launch military operations against the smugglers?
I think they kind of feel pretty much indifferent. I mean, this people smuggling or migration issue has been always in Libya, even under Gaddafi. People transited Libya to go to Europe, and then even Gaddafi invited many Africans to come here and to work in Libya. So most people don't really care about it. It's not much of an issue for them. They have bigger things to worry about, like lack of security, economic crisis, and, you know, their country falling apart. So the migrant issue is not really a topic people are really interested in Libya.
But do you get a sense that, for instance, I mean, given this huge influx of migrants, that there is rising xenophobia in Libya, or is there more solidarity there with the migrants?
Black people have been always treated badly in Libya, especially since the revolution, because, you know, some Africans fought on Gaddafi's side. So many people, I would say, just simply don't care. Now, I visited quite a few detention facilities. You've got like 700 people sharing one bathroom, and, you know, 100 people, you know, in one room. I mean, I visited a former school turned on to prison. Really, conditions are really terrible, but most people don't seem to care much about it, I think.
What can you tell us about the smugglers? Who are they?
Well, it seems to be kind of a cross-border network. I mean, there are definitely Libyans involved, but there are also other nationalities in every country. You know, you've got someone who ships them to the next one, like many of the Eritreans. They end up first in Sudan, Khartoum. Then they hook up with Sudanese smugglers who bring them, you know, across the border to Libya. Then Libyan counterparts takes over. So it's a real multinational corporation, you could say. It's really big business.
Looking ahead, Ulf, if the EU operation does go ahead, do you see any danger that the EU may get dragged into a Libyan civil war over the migration issue?
I'm not sure what the European Union hopes to achieve. I mean, these boats the smugglers use, they're like former shipping, fishermen's boats, not used any longer, dinghies, inflatables. I don't know what kind of military operation you would start against such boats. And the other thing is, often the smugglers are not on board. They just put the migrants in the boat, give them a GPS satellite phone, and off they go. So, I mean, any confrontation against such boats would only hit the migrants, which are already in a desperate situation, and not the smugglers who stay on shore just to, you know, organize the next shipment.
Thanks to Ulf Lessing from Reuters, speaking with me there from Tripoli in Libya.
This week, the United States released hundreds of documents they say were seized from Osama bin Laden's hideout in Abbottabad, Pakistan, during the raid when US commandos killed the al-Qaeda leader.
The declassified documents include American media articles and English language books, and an at first mundane-seeming job application form for would-be al-Qaeda members, which chillingly asked whether applicants were interested in carrying out a suicide operation, giving an insight into the man who masterminded the 9/11 attacks on the US while based in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan.
We're rewinding a bit now. For years, the CIA and other Western intelligence services funded religious seminaries in Pakistan in order to inculcate a generation of students to take up jihad and fight against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Many of the students who'd later make up the Afghan Taliban's leadership studied at the Darul Uloom Haqqaniyah, one of Pakistan's leading seminaries. Today, Samuel Haque, who heads the school, is still proud of his former students and the brutal interpretation of Islamic law they imposed in Afghanistan. DW's Naomi Conrad spent a day at the madrasa.
It's midday and the sun is relentlessly beating down on the students milling around in the courtyard of one of Pakistan's oldest and most famous religious seminaries, the Darul Uloom Haqqaniya. Young men in turbans and white and beige kaftans are sitting on rickety plastic chairs, chatting away in the shade of the university's white colonnade. A small group of students is gathered around a small table laden with white and beige layers of cloth. One man carefully picks up a white cloth and wraps it around his head, as his friends nod approvingly at his choice of a new turban. To their left, several older students have gathered by the main lecture hall, where generations of students have been taught a strict interpretation of Islam. This includes a polite 24-year-old student explains, who introduces himself as Muhammad, as his fellow students and teachers crowd around, a complete ban on music.
No. If anyone listens to music, it's a sin in Islam. It's prohibited in Islam.
But what if he gets on a bus where the driver is blaring out music? He smiles broadly, then shrugs.
I'll tell the driver that music is not good, that it's not Islamic. But if he doesn't listen to me, then I'll recite the Quran and try to concentrate on my work.
Mohammed makes his way back to the packed lecture hall, where, under whirring fans, endless rows of students are sitting cross-legged in front of small wooden benches laden with books. As I try to adjust the huge headscarf that keeps on slipping off my head, even Western women are requested to wear one on campus, a younger student sidles up to me. He would like to meet my Facebook friend, he whispers, blushing profusely, to improve his English. Then, as if scared by his own audacity, he scampers off into the hall, where the lecture is about to begin. 3,500 students from Pakistan and Afghanistan study at the Haqqaniya every year. Many are from families that are so poor that the madrasa, which offers free education, food and housing, is the only education available to them. They sleep on faded carpets, several boys to a room, where once their predecessors slept and studied. The men who would later go on to make up the leadership of the Afghan Taliban and install a brutal system in Afghanistan based on the teachings received in the Haqqaniya. The men include Osama bin Laden and Mullah Omar, the elusive head of the Taliban. In his dark, stuffy office lined with faded sofas, the school's headmaster, Samuel Haque, smiles.
Of course they were heroes. Look, if someone attacks your country, you have to defend it. It doesn't matter whether you're Muslim or not.
Ul Haque is a brusque, imposing man well into his 70s, immaculately dressed in a grey turban and beige cloak one of his sons brought before the interview. His sweet perfume wafts through the room as he recalls the time when the CIA and other Western intelligence officials courted him. Back then, the West poured millions into Pakistan's religious seminaries in order to indoctrinate a generation to take up jihad against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Many of Ul Haque's students took up arms. But, he says, as we walk across the campus and his son shoos away an inquisitive young student, he didn't send anyone to Afghanistan. They all went voluntarily. Does he agree with the system his students established in Afghanistan, a system where women were forced to wear burqas and adulterers were stoned?
You have to understand that the West didn't let the Taliban establish their system properly. But even so, even though they were fighting a war, they were able to establish peace in the entire country. There wasn't a single police station. But even so, criminals weren't tolerated, and as soon as they established the Sharia, all the blood feuds stopped immediately. No one even dared look at a woman.
Today, many of his students, who also take classes in computer sciences and English, go on to become imams and teachers, but also politicians and car mechanics.
Whatever they do, it's their duty to preach Islam in the entire world. It's their mission.
Back in Islamabad, a huge Pakistani flag is fluttering in the hot breeze outside the education ministry. Security guards place mirrors underneath every car, searching for explosives. For here, in Pakistan's capital, the authorities have begun to crack down on militants. And ever since militants stormed a military-run school in Peshawar and massacred more than 100 children last December, this includes a tighter control of the country's tens of thousands of madrasas. As education minister, it's Mohammed Balik Ur Rahman's job to geotag, register, and then monitor the country's religious seminaries. The softly spoken US-educated minister, with a long beard and a smart green waistcoat, concedes that there may be hundreds of thousands of madrasas. But for now, the government is focusing on the bigger seminaries. Within the next few months, his staff will now have to register as many as 35,000 schools. How many of them teach extremism?
The exact percentage wouldn't be known, but my guess would be that it has to be less than or 1% or 0.5% of the madrasas now.
Extremist schools, he stresses, would be closed down immediately. But what about schools like Haqqaniya, whose head calls Osama bin Laden and Mullah Omar heroes?
That could be personal freedom of speech or expression for anyone. For closing down a madrasa, any arms training, any militancy training can be a basis. Or if anyone is being taught to kill or inculcating such practices which would encourage people to take part in any extremist activity. So if an institute is found doing any such thing, that institute would be closed down.
If he could, he would like to educate all students in public schools. But in a country that spends 2% of its budget on education, it's likely to remain a pipe dream, he concedes. And public schools, too, often accused of teaching sectarianism. The next day, we make our way through the crowded streets of Rawalpindi, Islamabad's heaving sister city that houses the army headquarters. As donkeys meander through brightly painted rickshaws and expensive cars, pedestrians wander past the jewelers who have set up shop on the pavement, swatting flies from the trays of shimmering stones as they wait for customers. A small, dark madrasa is hidden down a small alleyway in a poorer neighbourhood, overlooked by one of the city's many watchtowers guarding the army barracks. Inside the dingy prayer room, several boys, some as young as 6 or 7, are bent over their books. Sitting on the worn carpet under a small window, the headmaster, a grim-looking man dressed in a long white kaftan, his beard dyed a dark black, surveys the small school he opened back in the mid-1990s. Idris Haqqaniya, who runs a network of 15 schools in poor neighbourhoods across Pakistan, studied in the Darul Ulum Haqqaniya in the 1980s. Many of his friends, he said, left for Afghanistan.
I did want to join the jihad, but you see, I just didn't find the time. I was too busy with my studies.
He too believes that Mullah Omar and Osama bin Laden are heroes. He too is convinced that the system his fellow students established in Afghanistan was a good one. It's his job, he says, to make sure his students in turn spread his teachings.
We need to fight for the implementation of Sharia. That's why we're teaching children.
He's convinced that one day a new system will prevail in Pakistan. A system where bus drivers are no longer allowed to blast their music through crackly loudspeakers. Then he politely asks us to leave. It's time for the evening prayer.
That report was from Naomi Conrad in Pakistan.
For DW's WorldLink, I'm Neil King in Bonn, Germany.
And I'm Samantha Early. You're listening to DW's WorldLink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Samantha Early.
And I'm Neil King. In this part of the show, meet a Serbian mother desperate to find the truth about her son, who disappeared shortly after birth.
The taboo of twins in eastern Madagascar.
One woman's ordeal with racism in Brazil shows the battle against discrimination is far from over.
Hey, I need a cleaner at my place. Can you go there and do the cleaning job? Then I'm like, no. Why not? I'm not a cleaner. Oh, I thought you were. I thought you were shopping for people you work for. And I was like, no, I'm shopping for myself.
And a sign of growing acceptance in California's bathrooms.
All this coming up in the next half hour here on WorldLink.
Imagine giving birth, then being told your baby had died and never being allowed to see the body or say goodbye. For about the past 5 decades, there have been reports of this happening in hospitals in Serbia.
Thousands of parents believe their newborns were kidnapped and sold to wealthy adoptive parents around the world by a large criminal network. But the way the law is set up in Serbia means not a single case has been officially investigated. That may be about to change, but for parents like the woman we're about to meet, it's come much too late. Nemanja Rujevic reports.
The appetizing smell of stuffed peppers welcomes visitors to the apartment of Pashija Rustemov. She's celebrating her 66th birthday and expecting her grandchildren to come over for lunch. Pashija doesn't actually know how many grandchildren she has, 12 at least, but there could be more. Her story begins on a July night in 1971 when she gave birth to her first son in the Narodni Front clinic in Belgrade, the biggest maternity hospital in Serbia. It was a big boy, she remembers. She also remembers the face of the doctor who took the crying baby into another room and then came back to express his condolences.
I grabbed his leg and said, "Please, show me my child. I wanted to hold him close to my chest. They gave me an injection and I fell asleep. I was semi-conscious for hours. I never saw that doctor again. A few days later, the hospital staff sent me home. They told me that they had already buried my son's body."
For the past 2 decades, Pashija and her family have been living in the town of Dorsten in western Germany. Serbian cable TV and a few black and white wedding photos are all that she has to remind her of homeland. As well as a thick folder full of documents which prove, Pashija says, that her son didn't die, but instead was kidnapped and sold. She shows me his official birth certificate, a cemetery report denying that her son was buried there, and even a document from the maternity clinic itself stating that no autopsy was carried out.
Normally you can't smuggle a single needle out of a hospital, let alone babies. Many people must have been involved, like nurses, doctors, officials who falsify the papers, middlemen.
Though dramatic, Pashija's story is far from unique. At least 3,000 Serbian mothers believe that their infants were sold on the black market to buyers from around the world who couldn't have their own children. Mirjana Novokmet is one of them. 13 years ago, she founded the Belgrade Association of Parents.
It often happened to young mothers and those who gave birth to twins. In those cases, the bigger baby would allegedly die. None of us had a chance to either identify the body or bury it. The medical staff told us that we were young and would be able to have more children later. The newborns obviously disappear between the hospital and cemetery. It's always the same pattern.
The pattern. Organized crime, the mafia, and an ignorant state. Not a single case has ever gone to court, and most popular bureaucratic explanation is the statute of limitations. According to Serbian law, there's a statute of limitations of 2 or 3 years for most alleged criminal acts, and maternity claims are limited to 10 years. But over the past decade, the scale of this scandal has been revealed, and as a result, various parents' organizations, legal experts, and public advocates have been urging politicians to change the laws so that old cases can be be investigated and prosecuted, but nothing has happened so far. Even the European Court of Justice has slammed Serbia vis-a-vis the missing babies, and it's ordered the government to pay 10,000 euros to one mother. Could the politicians in power be afraid of the names which could pop up in the investigation? Or have officials just been sloppy? I put this question to Leila Ruždić, a high-ranking official in the Democratic Party, which was in power for 12 years up until 2012. She was also in the parliamentary committee tasked with investigating this subject 10 years ago.
You know, what is political will? If a coalition government cannot agree on something, then a law cannot be changed. I admit that it's our fault that we haven't solved the problem of missing babies. But this question remains important to me, even today. Selling newborns on the black market is a profitable business, and I'm afraid it's still happening.
The new government, led by the Progressive Party, says it's keen to tackle the mystery. Serbia should introduce a special law on missing babies before the end of May, according to Borislav Vekic, the Deputy Minister of Health.
The Ministries of the Interior, Justice and Health are working intensively on resolving the case of the missing babies and bringing the truth to light.
But the current government is not yet prepared to appoint an independent investigative commission, which parents, group and experts are demanding. Back at her home in Germany, Pasha Rustemov is finishing off preparations for her birthday lunch. She says she's not expecting much from Serbia's politicians. For years, she's been carrying out her own investigation into what happened to her newborn baby. And she's tracked down a 43-year-old man in Belgrade who could be her biological son. Their first two meetings haven't gone as Pasha has hoped. She says the man was rude and even tried to blackmail her, demanding money in return for a DNA test. But Pasha won't quit until that test is carried out.
I'm not claiming anything. Maybe he is my son. Or maybe my son was sold somewhere in Germany, Italy or Sweden. It's a crime that's harmed thousands of babies, something like genocide. So how can that have a statute of limitations? And it's still happening, even today.
Pasha rushes to the kitchen to check on her stuffed peppers. The trick is to remove the cover from the casserole dish for the last half hour, she says, and her grandchildren are about to arrive.
That story from Nemanja Vrujovic, reporting from Western Germany.
From a mother battling to meet the baby she never knew, to one who gave up her newborns at birth because there were two of them. According to local custom on the east coast of Madagascar, if a woman gives birth to twins, she has to give them away. That's because, in local belief, twins are cursed and bring bad luck.
And if parents refuse to give their babies up, they face expulsion from the community. Our correspondent Jan-Philipp Schlüter met mothers in Madagascar who complied with their people's tradition and others who defied it. His report is presented by Anke Rasper.
In December
1988, I gave birth to twins, two boys. It was absolutely off limits. While I was still in the delivery room, my parents pressured me to follow our tradition and get rid of the children. When I gave them away, my parents congratulated me.
Marie-Louise sits upright on her dark plushy couch, decorated with silver flower embroidery, inside her humble but spotless hut. She is surrounded by crocheted doilies and cushions. A vase with plastic flowers stands on a low coffee table. The 63-year-old rests her interlocked fingers on her lap, kneading her hands, a shy smile on her face. It's hard for her to talk about the twins she had to give away.
I haven't seen the children since they were born. The nuns who helped me after the birth, they took them straight to the convent and took care of them there. One of the nuns had a cousin in Canada who adopted the boys. I asked them to name them Tulu Sanari and Nomen Sanari, which is Madagascan and means sent by God. The foster parents granted me this wish.
Marie-Louise is not the only one to have gone through this experience. Here in the coastal town of Mananjari on Madagascar's eastern seaboard, tradition still plays a major role in daily life. This is particularly true when it comes to the Antambawaka, who make up the majority of the population here. Nicole is a man of small stature with an impish grin. But when it comes to tradition, he doesn't joke around.
Our people consider twins to be expendable animals. There is no room for them here.
Nicole has clout. He is one of the local chiefs. As a leader, he strictly watches over the century-old tradition of the Antambawaka. For them, twins are cursed. They bring bad luck. For example, according to legend, twins were to blame for the defeat the locals suffered against the French colonialists. One of the queens back then supposedly left her twins behind when she fled the fighting. The soldiers who were ordered to save the children were massacred by the enemy. Of course, there's no historical evidence to back up this story. In the old days, twins were often killed. Even today, killings are said to still take place in remote areas. But as a rule, the children are simply given away. Mothers who refuse to comply are expelled from their homes and forced to leave their village. A few kilometers from the center of Mananjari, along a stretch of bumpy road and across a soccer field, there's a property run by the NGO, Tsimanari Zaza, which translates to "Don't throw away children." A few twin children are playing between faded and torn tents where they live with their mothers. There are also two relatively new houses, but they haven't been furnished yet. Tsimanari Zaza offers support and shelter to twins and mothers who have been kicked out of their community, like 33-year-old Razafi.
I didn't know that I was expecting twins, so I was quite surprised when the midwife told me. I knew immediately that I wanted to keep my children, whatever it takes. My parents told me it would be better if I left. I wasn't allowed to come home again, so I stayed in several help centers, and now I'm here.
Patrice and Patricia are 3.5 years old. It's unclear what the future holds for the little family. They can stay with the aid agency for a maximum of 5 years, but after that, they have to find something new. For Razafi, returning to her family is not an option. The force of local traditions, pressure from society, and the fear of being an outcast are often just far too overwhelming. On top of that, there's the daunting prospect of supporting two children in one of the world's poorest regions. Mike Angelico runs the Center of Hope Marie-Christelle, a children's home financed by the French aid agency Fanatenon. Whenever twins are born in the local hospital, his cell phone rings.
Quand les médecins appellent, je vais aller là-bas.
Then I drive straight to the hospital, even at night, and try to convince the parents to keep their children. I tell them that I'm a twin myself and that I can help them with clothing, medication, and food. Sometimes the parents give in. If not, we take the newborn babies with us.
Often they have to hurry because some parents refuse to clothe the newborns or feed them with milk. There are now 62 children living here at the center. But, Mike says, admitting twins is only a last resort. What he and his team really want to do is convince the parents to accept their children.
We want to get rid of this taboo step by step. That means that even if the twins first stay with us, we try to get them close to their parents again. The parents come to see their children now and again and spend time with them. After a while, we bring the kids to them for several days, so they have a chance to get used to the whole situation, for example, during school vacations. We also bring clothes and food with us to support them. We work step by step until the parents are willing to take their children back.
Back in Marie-Louise's small hut, the walls are adorned with photographs of her 6 children and grandchildren. Next to them, in a clear plastic cover, there's a picture of one of the twin boys she gave away. She's never talked to him, but her youngest son recently got in touch with his brother on Facebook. The 63-year-old Marie-Louise smiles cautiously as she reveals her greatest wish.
One day I hope my twins can come to Madagascar and I'll be able to see them. The foster parents have promised me that they will try and make my wish come true.
That report by Jan-Philipp Schlüter was presented by Anke Rasper.
For decades, Brazil has been branded as a racial democracy where people of all colours live in great harmony. The South American countries attracted delegations from nations like the US, South Africa and Malaysia that want to combat racism. This insults Brazilian Hannah Souza, who's dark-skinned and says she suffers from racism and discrimination almost everywhere she goes. Eskimo reports.
As a vegan, Hani Souza likes to do much of her shopping in special supermarkets in Leblon, one of Rio's most wealthy neighborhoods.
Só tem essa marca, né, moço? Só essa, né? Obrigada.
Every time Souza goes around filling her cart with groceries, she notices how some of her fellow shoppers stop what they're doing for a moment and look at her.
People stare. You're like, well, you're not the regular customer. And then they're like, what's she doing here?
Hani Souza has dark skin, like most of the other customers in this affluent neighborhood. Some shoppers do even more than stare. Some approach her, looking for someone to do their dirty work.
Hey, I need a cleaner at my place. Can you go there and do the cleaning job?
Then I'm like, no.
Why not?
I'm not a cleaner.
Oh, I thought you were. I thought you were shopping for people you work for.
And I was like, no, I'm shopping for myself.
30-year-old Hannah Souza is a language teacher, has a university degree, and aims to become a diplomat. She wouldn't have taken much notice of the offer to clean a fellow customer's house if it had just happened once, she says. But that's not the case.
No, it happened 7 times in all of the cities that I've lived.
Many Brazilians never talk about racism, or they simply refuse that it happens. Souza says some still actually hail Brazil for being a racial democracy where people of all colors live in harmony. This idea dates back to 1933 and the sociologist Gilberto Freire. Freire argued that Brazil's population was so mixed after centuries of slavery that the question of color would completely dissolve, meaning equal opportunities for all.
It feels like a joke, basically. He claimed that almost 100 years ago, right? But back then it was a joke, and still it's a joke. And some people, they say, oh, there's no racism in Brazil. Some people say that now, and they use his ideas to support their argument.
Souza says her daily life is proof that racism still exists here. It gets even worse when people talk explicitly about the color of her skin.
Nega preta, it's a combination. So it's black negro.
Or when she's compared to animals.
Focinho de porco, pig's nose.
Or a monkey.
Oh, this one is horrible as well. Macaca.
And the list could go on. But the verbal insults don't even get to her anymore, Souza says.
I've grown a hard skin about it. And I deal with that quite often. So.
What does get to Souza is that many Brazilians refuse to talk about racism and fail to recognize that colored people are often discriminated. That even goes for many of Souza's own friends.
It hurts me because it's as if people didn't acknowledge what people like me, people from my family, go through.
Racism has deep historic roots in Brazil. From the 16th century until the mid-1800s, Brazil received millions of slaves from Africa, around 11 times more than to North America. And Brazil was the last nation in the Americas to abolish slavery in 1888. The UN was on official visit to Brazil a few years ago to investigate how much rights of blacks have developed since then. UN officials stated that Afro-Brazilians make up more than half the country's population, but are largely underrepresented and almost invisible in powerful positions in the media and the private sector. For example, only few members of President Dilma Rousseff's government are colored.
Historical inequalities continue to fundamentally affect millions of Afro-Brazilians and is present at all levels of Brazilian society,
said Miguel Fanon Mendes France from the United Nations, and concluded,
the dismantling of racial discrimination remains slow in Brazil.
As the country's first black president of the Supreme Court Justice, Joaquim Barbosa, once said,
racism in Brazil is well hidden, subtle and unspoken, underestimated by the media. It is nevertheless extremely violent.
That reality is apparent for Ana Souza as well. We're getting on a bus with her to find out what she once experienced in the city of Belo Horizonte. It was a Sunday afternoon, and the local soccer clubs were playing. At a red light, soccer fans from another bus began to shout at her through the bus windows. And while the buses waited for the light to turn green, the verbal beating escalated.
They were saying that I should die because I have bad hair, and they started spitting at me. One guy was making gestures as well. You know, I couldn't believe it. I was shocked. And then when I left the bus, I saw that the bus driver was really upset about it. He called me daughter. He said, "Filha, eu sinto muito." It's like, daughter, I'm sorry.
But things are getting a little better, says Souza. We walk with her to a kiosk, and she buys a newspaper to show us what she means.
Jornal Globo, por favor. So here, the jobs section.
Souza is looking for the Portuguese term boa aparência, or good appearance, as a requirement in the hundreds of job ads. According to Souza, this used to be a way for employers to indicate that they won't hire black applicants. Souza scans through page after page and doesn't find the expression anymore.
That's it. Wonderful. No boa aparência. Yay.
What does that tell you?
Well, I get happy about it. Less people with crazy ideas. Things are getting better, see?
But things aren't changing as fast as she'd like to see. Back in the supermarket, Souza expects to receive new offers from other customers that need a cleaning lady.
Well, we still need to work on the race issues. People cannot ignore that race issues exist.
Asghar Mo with that story from Brazil.
Our exploration of the battle against discrimination continues with our final story this week. It's about that most basic of human functions, using a public restroom, which for transgender people can at times be a frightening ordeal when others object to their choice of using the male or female toilets. A city in the US state of California has addressed this issue by introducing gender-neutral bathrooms. Lena Nozizwe has more.
Exactly. You love them, but they hurt.
I know. Although, when you really find that pair that doesn't...
With her scarlet lips, flowing hair, and stylish stilettos, it is not surprising to hear that Drian Juarez enjoys being a woman.
Well, you know, I tend to be femme. I'm a femme-presenting trans woman, so I like being perceived as female and being read as female. So I have long hair. I usually wear heels. I love heels.
She was born male 42 years ago, but Juarez has lived about half of her life as a woman. She's even gone to the courts to legally become female. But when it comes to using the bathroom that conforms to her current ID, her heels have only taken her so far in the court of public opinion.
It's been about, you know, especially when I was earlier in transition, you know, people telling me I couldn't go into the restroom, or people actually physically grabbing me and pulling me out of a restroom and telling me that, you know, you can't go into this restroom. You know, I've definitely had those experiences. And it's frightening, especially when you're out with your family and you just go into the restroom like anybody else and somebody points you out and outs you amongst a bunch of strangers or is saying that you're dangerous just because of who you are.
But on this day, she walks with confidence to the back of Pizza Rustica, a restaurant in West Hollywood, California, where she finds two restrooms with matching signs.
So if you look at the signs now, you have a circle, and within the circle you have the outline of a woman and the outline of a man. The woman looks like she's wearing a dress in this outline. The man looks like he's wearing pants. And then it says restroom. So it, you know, clearly shows that anybody can enter the restroom.
Thanks in part to Juarez, earlier this year, the city of West Hollywood became the first city in California to enact a law that requires all businesses with single-stall bathrooms to make them gender-neutral.
So some people might call them unisex bathrooms. Some people might call them single, you know, gender-neutral bathrooms.
Abby Land was instrumental in making gender-neutral bathrooms law during her tenure at the City Council of West Hollywood.
But it's a very easy thing, and really it was about businesses taking down one sign and putting up a sign that says, "You're welcome here."
Land, both a former mayor and city council member, says the last she heard, no businesses and no patrons have complained about complying with the unisex bathroom law. Jody Herman is a scholar at the Williams Institute, a think tank based at the University of California, Los Angeles, that focuses on LGBT issues. Herman says that West Hollywood is the rare city in the U.S. with gender-neutral bathrooms.
It's really a patchwork of laws across the country right now, so it really depends on where you are, whether or not you are protected by the law in your choice of restroom.
Researcher Herman conducted a study on the nation's capital that found that 70% of transgender and gender non-conforming respondents reported being denied access to public restrooms, and in addition, they experienced verbal harassment and or physical assault. Her survey also revealed the health impact of bathroom insecurity.
Sometimes trans folks will just not use the restroom at all, even when they need to. And this is something that my survey respondents reported in Washington, D.C., and it can have a negative impact on your physical health. Sometimes people reported having urinary tract infections, causing complications with their bladder infections, even kidney damage or problems with their kidneys, just because of this bathroom issue.
State legislators in both Arizona and Florida have promoted bills that would criminalize men and women who go to bathrooms that do not conform with the sex on their birth certificate. The lawmakers repeatedly say their motivation for trying to pass the bills is public safety. While researcher Herman says there are incidents of transgender men and women getting harassed and hurt in public bathrooms, she says there is no evidence of the transgender population inflicting the violence. Juarez, an appointee who sits on West Hollywood's Transgender Advisory Board, knows critics think the idea of gender-neutral bathrooms is extreme. But she says members of the general public may be more accustomed to the idea than they realize.
With trans people, it's a fixation on what's between our legs, because the concept is that if we don't have the genitals that match that bathroom, then we're dangerous, that somehow we're out to do something devious in the restrooms. And so it's about challenging people to not have that knee-jerk reaction to fear of, oh my God, what does this mean? But to give it a chance. I bet most people listening to the show will have been in the restroom with a transgender person, either a tall woman who was in the restroom or a very petite man who was in the restroom. Because they didn't know that person was trans, they used the restroom and they left. But once they know that person is trans, all of a sudden it becomes a fearful thing. And so it's about really taking a step back and thinking, well, what am I afraid of? What do I think is going to happen in the bathroom? What historically has happened with trans people using the restroom? And the answer is nothing. People use the restroom and they leave, and that's it.
And that goes for the femme-presenting trans woman with scarlet lips, flowing hair, and stylish stilettos.
Lena Nozizwe reporting there from California.
Well, when you've got to go, you've got to go. And we've got to go now. We've reached the end of today's programme. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll tune in again next week for more personal stories from around the globe.
WorldLink was produced by Neil King and Samantha Early, and our sound engineers were Gyat Gyogi and Jürgen Kuhn. And if you'd like to hear these stories again, you can go to our website at dw.de/WorldLink. WorldLink is brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany. From the fading light.